Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 12-806, Gordon versus Gordon. Arguing for the petitioner, Peter Van Dam Esser. Arguing for the respondent, Samuel King Jr. Argument on the merits.
Good morning, Mr. Esser, Mr. King. Are you both ready to proceed today?
Yes.
All right. And you've reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal, Mr. Esser, so we'll give you a warning with 10 minutes to go. Mr. King, we'll give you a warning with 5 minutes to go. So please proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. This is a divorce case, and I represent Ira Gordon. This is a case basically that was decided by a minute order. That minute order contained two critical paragraphs that basically summed up the reasons for the court's ruling. The court did not sign any of the formal divorce documents. They were signed by the...
You didn't raise that issue in the cert?
No, I didn't. But I think it's part of the case in front of this court. No, I left it out and focused on other issues. Anyway, two paragraphs in that ruling, one involving alimony and the other involving property division, and both of them focused on 20 years of alleged financial misconduct, both for purposes of alimony and for purposes of property division.
Now those, that passages, those are actually not only in the minute order, they're in the divorce decree too.
Yes, they were put in the divorce decree. We claimed there were some differences, but for purposes of formal documents, Judge Browning signed a divorce decree with those two paragraphs there. There was no property division chart. There was no calculation of values. There was no categorization of any of the marital assets. And that's the primary complaint that we have in front of this court. And that complaint isn't just focused on the vagueness that produces, but it also makes the other arguments very difficult to make. In terms of complaining whether or not my client's substantial Category 1 assets were taken into consideration, we have no idea. And in fact, if you look at the part of the ICA decision that was reversed involving that Maui land investment, based on the fact that we have no idea what the judge did for purposes of the other assets in the decree, we really have no idea what impact that the judge that receives that case when it goes back on remand
has. What was the value that was assessed for that Maui property?
According to the stipulation, at date of marriage, it was a $538,000 property. It was a one-third ownership of a $1.5 million investment. The lots were subdivided and sold in 2004, and at date of trial, it wasn't worth anything.
No, my question is, we actually have no idea in the divorce decree. I mean, there was no value assessed, period.
That's correct.
In the divorce decree, so we have absolutely no idea.
Well, you have some idea because the appraisals were stipulated. In other words, they weren't just introduced at the trial, they were stipulated. And those, by the way, those appraisals did not just include the properties, but also the retirement funds. And you also have a bank statement that was admitted in the trial. It was a year after date of marriage, which listed the amounts, I think it was 2 months after the date of marriage, that listed all of the mortgage balances. So it's pretty clear from the record what those date of marriage values were. Now, appellate counsel's raised this new argument focused on PEP, which essentially says date of marriage values don't matter in this case because there was a PEP.
Trial judge specifically found there to be a PEP.
That's correct. And of course, the only application in 242 findings of fact of that PEP ruling, Your Honor, and I think it's number 56, is that focused on the Logo Lock investment and whether or not that was whether or not she participated in that investment. There was no argument below that the PEP invalidated the Dome schedule. In other words, all of the rest of the findings of fact that focused on Category 1 assets. For instance, there's two Category 1 assets found in favor of Susan. One involves a debenture, $108,000 debenture. The other one involves a $220,000 investment in the marital residence. Both of those are valued as of date of marriage. Which, and if you look at the conclusions of law, the second to the last one, which is number 35, on the last page of the findings, the court finds that the category two on the retirement funds from the date of marriage is 50-50 divided by the parties. Now, she didn't do that in the divorce decree, but the point being that the PEP was not used for that argument below. The court didn't make that finding. The only impact of the PEP was to attack the low-to-lock investment.
If there was a PEP, would it have been possible for the family court to have found that the home and the mortgage on the Las Vegas property was separate property? Aren't they contradictory in a sense that if she finds a PEP, how can they be separate property?
Yeah, that's a good point. And I make that in the reply brief. If the category, if there's a $220,000 category one credit, which they expressly find, I think it's finding in fact 35, for the Mahono Loop property, then how can you also use that as an example of establishing a PEP? And it's exactly the same with the Las Vegas condo. I mean, she didn't just hand him the $30,000. She got a second mortgage on his condo, which is listed as a Category 1 property.
You know, let me ask you this. It appears that you're analyzing, I understand the concern about the standard partnership model. But it appears that the trial judge ultimately ruled that she wasn't going to follow the partnership model, and that valid and relevant considerations required or would allow for deviation from the partnership model. So why is all of this that important if she decided to deviate?
Okay, for a couple of reasons. First of all, the primary argument in the answering brief against our arguments involving deviation was that it didn't matter. In other words, the court divided up the estates 50-50, and there was no category one, so therefore this is fair, and it doesn't matter that the court did not value or categorize any property. So that is why we have to make the argument about what those properties are worth. But more importantly, the deviation argument, which is a long line of ICA cases, the only involvement I know of this court in deviation and dissipation, that basically the Higashi case, where this court denied cert. All the other opinions I cited in my briefs and address dissipation and deviation are all ICA decisions. I sort of assumed we were granted cert, but that was part of the reason that you wanted to look this over, because there's no Supreme Court authority. Those cases, though, go back to ALO, which is back in the 80s. It's like 25, 30 years of authority that says that if it's dissipation prior to the filing of the divorce decree, that it is not.
That's not exactly what Higashi says, right?
That's exactly
it's,
what
it's material. It's facts Higashi that says. that lead to the dissolution of divorce, right? But right. In terms of examining the Higashi test, is not exactly as you've stated, but going back to the statutes, if that's what Higashi says, then does that follow the legislature's intent to allow the judge's discretion based on the circumstances? I mean, it seems that you are arguing that if one spouse, without telling the other spouse that he or she has another family that he or she is supporting, and the other spouse is innocent and knows nothing about it, or that spouse decides to just gamble away all of the marital assets because divorce was not contemplated at that time, that cannot constitute marital waste, which can be taken into account at the time of divorce. Is that something that you think that the legislature intended?
Yes. And there are so many ICA cases saying that Hatoyama is probably the best example, 9 Hawaii Ave. Hatoyama says divorce isn't getting even for all the bad things that happen during the marriage. Divorce, it matters what happens in terms of dissipation, but during the divorce itself.
Well, what were the facts of Hatoyama? What were the facts of Hatoyama? What was the issue with dissipation?
The facts of Hatoyama are that 2 years prior to the filing of the divorce, one of the parties gave a huge chunk of property to a son from another marriage. You know, in other words, trying to deplete the marital estate. And Hatoyama said, sorry, that happened before the divorce was filed. And Judge Burns, you know, for better or for worse, put this solid language in there saying, hey, you don't get even with everybody in a divorce. What you do in terms of dissipation is you look in terms of whether it was done in order to influence the divorce result. And in Hatoyama, Burns said that can't be because it happened 2 years before the divorce was filed. Now, as I
wouldn't we be getting back to, one of the underlying principles is no-fault divorce. I mean, in other words, if we're gonna start looking backwards, then every single financial management decision, it doesn't have to be wasteful, it could just be negligent. We're going to be looking at whether re-examining what both parties did about every financial decision.
That's, of course, what Burns said. And that helps us, you know, in terms of not knowing about his family. Of course, those facts don't apply in this case. In this case, Susan knew all, met his daughter and knew all about his family. But the point being that that's exactly the point. If you go back to 44 Hawaiian Richards, it says this is a no-fault state, and it says you don't use a divorce to essentially pay back. It is true that a lot of divorce cases have a lot of testimony about how bad the opposing party is, but that Richards had cited over and over again, and of course Richards is a Hawaii Supreme Court case, that essentially says that's not what the focus is of a property division. But let's focus on the primary thing the ICA focused on, and that is the tax issue. The $140,000 tax delinquency. That certainly isn't immoral or terrible. That is basically what you bottom line say is financial mismanagement or whatever. Now, keep in mind that the findings said that that Ira asserted that the reason he didn't pay those taxes because he wanted to negotiate a lower payment. That's right in the findings. And the findings don't contest that fact.
And the findings also say that he deviated some of the funds that were supposed to be used to buy jewelry for his new girlfriend.
A total of $30,000 and a $1.5 million a case. That's a very telling thing because look at the amount of money that was borrowed. $450,000 was borrowed. $150,000 was used to pay off a previous mortgage. $103,000 was paid for taxes. But let's look at the $140,000, and this is right in the findings. What did that $140,000 consist of? It consisted of $116,000 balance due from 2004 to 2005 and a $24,000 interest and penalties. When the judge says in her minute order that she had every right in the world to make Ira pay the $140,000 for taxes, under what theory? The couple owed those taxes in 2004 to 2005.
Was
the only negative impact of waiting until Dopot to pay them was interest and penalties, $24,000.
Wasn't that what the judge decided, though? That because a lot of the Mrs. Gordon thought that the taxes had been paid out of the home equity line, and a lot of the accrual, the reason why it grew so large was because he didn't pay it, and it was after the date of.
But how large was it? You can't ignore a finding of fact that says the $140,000 consists of the original amount due, which is $116,000. $24,000 in penalties and interest. That's what the record says. She pretends like it's the whole $140,000, but what are the facts? And the facts were drafted, of course, by Susan, and the facts say that it's $116,000 plus $24,000. But the point, that becomes irrelevant, again, Justice McKenna, because it happened before Dostot. It happened before the filing of the divorce.
Well, we don't know. Seems to me a significant issue. We don't really know because the family court never made a finding when the final separation date was.
Well, that's true, but the court did make a finding that the loan was taken out on the house on March 12, 2010. And she filed for divorce on July 10.
But he had already bought tickets for his girlfriend and the daughter in December of 2008, and you know he admitted that the relation, he had basically moved in as of 2009 and had paid for repairs and renovations to her condo. But you know, even just looking at Higashi, it's not just Dosikod, and it seems like some of the cases have suggested that. But what about the prong in Higashi that says the date one or both of the parties took a substantial step toward the dofsicod that subsequently occurred. In other words, a substantial step toward the date of final separation and contemplation of divorce. Isn't buying tickets, plane tickets for your new girlfriend and her daughter and paying for her renovations and having this secret relationship and live, you know, staying with her, isn't that a substantial step toward dofsicod?
With respect, absolutely not.
It isn't.
Having an extramarital affair is not announcing you want to get divorced. I mean, if that were true, you'd have all these.
If, but Higashi says that if the final separation and contemplation of divorce actually occurs, then you can consider the substantial step.
Well,
it doesn't say that if you have an extramarital.
Please allow Justice McKenna to finish her question.
All right.
Thank you.
And so, therefore,
she's still finishing her question, Mr. Esser. I think she was still talking. So please don't talk over. It makes it very hard. I know you really want to get your arguments out.
So it is your position that the actions that he took, at least as of 2008, do not constitute a substantial step toward dofsicod.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yes. Now, let's look at the remodeling you just mentioned. That was the remodeling of a marital asset, 3102, in an apartment building. That was valued as a dope pot, and it passed as a marital asset. If it was remodeled, Susan captured whatever share there was of that. So that's a non-issue. The fact that the girlfriend was living there, so what? If it was remodeled, it's a marital asset. And you know, in terms of the other, we stipulated to 31,000. The court came down with 41,000. Let's assume, okay, that there was 41,000. That is not what the famous paragraph in the minute order said. What the famous paragraph said is 20 years of financial misconduct. This isn't a small violation that the ICA suggests of quibbling over whether the dofsicod was when he started going out with a masseuse and when he borrowed the money. This is 20 years. This is going back to before they were even married. This is a huge violation of Higashi. This isn't a little one. And keep in mind that your focus on the girlfriend is not in that order. It's not in the minute order. That's in the answering brief and the ICA's opinion. Because the primary focus by this judge was that because of financial misconduct over 20 years, which takes you back before date of marriage, that she was going to essentially give this lady $100,000 more in alimony than she asked for. And split a marital estate 50-50 down the line when he had $1.5 million in assets at date of marriage.
Didn't the family court find and sort of recount the whole history of how the evidence regarding this relationship unfolded at trial? And finally, at the end of that, noted defendant admitted the relationship began in early 2009. Is that not sufficient to constitute a finding of a substantial step towards a separation and contemplation of divorce? That's what I think the ICA concluded. Are you saying that's not sufficient as a matter of law, or it's not sufficiently explicit, or both?
What I'm asking this court to consider, Your Honor, and that's a good question. There are four separate decisions in terms of awards of property division that are based on DOM. They're not based on anything else. They're based on DOM. And so, therefore, deciding that PEP is relevant and having that change the whole formula, which is what the ICA said, makes no sense. Let's look for purposes let's look at the date of the divorce and figure out whether or not the court used that amount, that date, 2009, or any other pre-dofsicod date. And this is what I wanted to point out. The date of separation, finding fact 49, court parties lived in the house until July 2010 and lived as husband and wife. That's finding 49. That doesn't sound much like 2009, does it? Finding fact 230, at the time of separation in July 2010, Finding of fact 232, at the time of separation in July 2010, finding of fact 51, living as husband and wife in July of 2010. You can't have it both ways. And this 2009 stuff, that's all thrown into an answering brief. That is not in the findings of fact. The findings of fact say this couple had a fight in July of 2010 over this girlfriend and over the some of these expenses, and that's why she filed for divorce. You can't create dates when the finding of a fact that were prepared by Susan say otherwise. So let's look at those two critical dates. PEP versus DOM. There's at least four separate references in the findings that use DOM, involving the retirement accounts, involving the Category 2, and they say that the debenture, the $108,000 debenture, is a Category 1 for wife because she had it at date of marriage, not PEP, not in Las Vegas, not in 1992. I also point out that the PEP is useless for purposes of this division because it's not dated. How do you decide what's pre or post PEP if it's not dated? There's no attempt by the court whatsoever to give a date for PEP. And the court itself uses DOM elsewhere. I'm going to save the rest of my time unless there are any more questions.
I have a question. Mr. Esser, are you arguing that the whole case has to be retried?
Yes.
Retried, not just findings in it. And the reason for that, as opposed to perhaps remanding it for findings?
The difficulty you have is that sending this back on the record, and where a judge, I don't even know if she's still sitting as a per diem, and if this went back to a different judge, I think it clearly has to be retried. If it goes back to the same judge, the problem you have is that there's a real bias in this record. The bias is basically he done her wrong, and so therefore she gets a huge amount of alimony and a huge amount of property division. This case should be retried. That's what I asked for in my opening brief.
Okay, thank you.
It leaves the court. Sam King again for the wife. I'll call her Ms. Gordon, even though I think she changed her name to Parrish in the degree. As Mr. Esser mentioned, he raised four issues in his opening brief, originally down below, but he abandoned that final issue about who signed the decree, which I think was properly abandoned because I spent a lot of time in my brief showing that when Judge Browning signed, all he did was a pro forma signing, which specifically tracked what the minute order said. So basically, he's raised three issues in his petition for cert. And let me just say them real quickly, and then I'll go back over them. His first issue is no property chart was supplied, no categorization of property, and so on. Second one is the VARPs. The valid and relevant considerations were not properly awarded. And thirdly is alimony. Now, if you look at the record, basically what the husband's idea of a fair divorce settlement in this case, a fair result of the divorce, would be the wife gets absolutely nothing. That was his idea of a fair result. Absolutely nothing.
I mean, that seems to have been your argument, that because he may have brought more separate property, but why doesn't the family court have total authority once it divides the property pursuant to the partnership model to adjust in any way it feels appropriate, is just and equitable?
It can to a certain degree.
I mean, none of this property is marital separate property. None
that's
of it.
Correct.
So the family court had full authority. So I'm not sure when you argue that the family court would have somehow been locked in, even if it had gone through, the family court could have, theoretically, the family court maybe could have reached the same result it did in this case, but it didn't do it in accordance with the law that's been pretty well settled in this jurisdiction.
Yeah, well, see, that's where I would disagree. And I think the reason for that, and the key to this entire case, is PEP, premarital economic partnership. The PEP, and it's specific, the judge specifically sets out, and I think the Chief Justice stated that in the findings of fact, the whole history of this marriage is set out, and also Ms. Gordon testified about that. And the court found that the economic partnership was started in 92-93. That's when she was living in Vegas.
It didn't give a date, exactly.
No, it didn't give an exact date, but, you know, when you're dealing with economic partnership, that may be a difficult thing to do. I would say the latest date that the court, family court gave would have been when she moved to Hawaii to start living with him and brought her dog. They didn't mention her dog came with her. That was in around early 93.
So we're relegated to guessing. What was in the family court's mind?
It's not guessing because it was the time frame is relatively short. She met him in the middle of 92 in Vegas when she was as Mr. Escher loves to call a prostitute, but it's legal in Vegas. The evidence is clear that and even before she moved to Hawaii, she was starting to loan him money and, you know, bail him out of tax problems. But she moved and started living with him in 93, early 93.
Mr. King, let's assume that there was an economic partnership with the family court.
Right.
Okay. But the family court also found, finding fact 140, defendant brought numerous real properties into the economic partnership and marriage with plaintiff. So regardless if there was an economic partnership from the very beginning, the court finds that the defendant brought numerous real properties. The court then goes on and says there's a stipulation as to value, and then the court says they were not encumbered. So we have all these findings that regardless if there's an economic partnership, that the defendant and your client brought separate properties into it. The problem is that there's no assessment of any of this.
That's when a party claims Category 1, in this case it's mostly Category 1 or Category 3, so I'll stick to Category 1. When a party claims Category 1 credit, that party has the burden of proof to prove the Category 1
but
credit.
But there was a stipulation. It was in the proposed findings. Excuse me, let me finish.
Yeah.
There were proposed findings from the other side. It was your side that submitted proposed findings, which the family court adopted, that didn't have values in it. In my view, I think that's where all the problems were created.
When I first looked at this case and saw exactly what you saw, I thought, whoa, we've got a decree here that doesn't have any values. This, you know, how am I going to, because I wasn't the trial attorney. So I started looking into it, and eventually I was able to, I even put it in my answering brief, and because the parties did stipulate to values on the date of trial, they did stipulate to values, but they stipulated to values for trial purposes. That doesn't mean, and they stipulated to values, I think, on date of marriage too, but that doesn't mean that Mrs. Gordon was conceding that those date of marriage values should be Category 1 values to Mr. Gordon. And Mr. Escher argued that the PEP bomb was dropped by Mrs. Gordon's attorney only for the first time in post-trial briefing. That is not true. If you take a look at the transcript from the first day of trial, page 14, when Ms. Parrott, who was representing Mrs. Gordon, in her initial argument to the court, she argued PEP. On page 14, and Ms. Dong, sitting back here watching this argument, her response to that was not, oh, you've never raised this issue before. Her response to that was, wait a minute, you can't argue that PEP doesn't apply because Mr. Gordon was married until 1996. And that's been their argument all along. That the real argument isn't that there was no PEP. The real argument is that, you can't have it, even if there was one, it doesn't count because until Mr. Gordon gets divorced, it doesn't cut in. That's the real argument.
So if a court, as this trial court did, says that she is going to deviate from the partnership model,
right,
I'm not going to follow the partnership model. There are valid and relevant considerations.
Right.
How is the whole issue of the existence of a premarital economic partnership and whatever Category 1 might have been, I could see the potential relevance, but how could that be error if she has decided to deviate from the partnership model?
She did decide to make, I heard your questions before, she did decide to deviate from the partnership model, but only as to certain assets.
Okay.
It wasn't a huge deviation either. I put that in my brief. I think the deviation only amounted to like $90,000 or something when you do the math and you say, what's the difference between 75% and 50%? And you, I think it was like 350. Only about 350,000 of this entire estate did she deviate on. The rest of it she didn't. So, you know, frankly, if I had been the one drafting up the findings of fact, I wouldn't have done it quite this way. But I don't think it's an error. It rises to the level of error. Yes, it's true. I think it's true that there are findings of fact that, you know, look like they're somewhat inconsistent. But when you take the whole picture, it's not. I mean, what they're complaining about is, as I say, it started from the beginning. What they wanted was a zero case, where she gets zero and he gets everything. That's what they're complaining about. And the judge, in fact, after an almost 20-year relationship, starting back in 93, divides the assets 50-50. What's the problem with that?
Well, and then, but our law says you should divide it according to the partnership model. And then, once you determine what it's going to come out to, then you determine if you're going to deviate and the extent of the deviation. Right. What the family court did here was say, I'm not going to follow, I don't care what the ICA and these cases have said. We have this exact order, classifying in categories, figuring all this out. Family court just, I'm going to do this half and half, and just jumps to the conclusion and doesn't go through any of the outline of how family court is supposed to be doing this.
I agree to the extent that it's not, the court could have done a much better job, and the findings of fact and conclusions of law could have done a much better job showing what the court did. But I don't agree that the court just didn't follow it. The court, if you take, that's why I say the key to this whole case is, when did the economic partnership start? Did it start on the date of marriage, as Mr. Esser's claiming, or did it start back in, at the latest, say mid-1993, when she moved to Hawaii and started living with him and paying his taxes and cashing in her $100,000 CD, and, you know, where'd all this money go? And then she takes out this huge loan, he puts $200,000 in the bank, and most of it disappears. And they were starting businesses together in Vegas during this whole period of time. Then she buys a house, and they started living together in her house in 95. They were living together for years before they got married. Yes, she knew about the marriage that existed with him with his other wife, but if you take the economic partnership starting in 92 then, or 93, then there's no, she did, the judge, if that's true, and there's no evidence, the burden of proof was on Mr. Gordon to show, okay, if you're claiming Category 1 credit and the economic partnership started in 93, what's the value that you're claiming for 93? He didn't prove that. If he didn't, boom, you're just into 50-50. And that's what the judge did, 50-50. So she did follow the partnership model. You just have to figure out where did she start from. And she specifically held, as Justice McKenna said, that there was a PEP in this case. So she did follow the partnership model.
And
there were these little variations in there. Frankly, and I put in my brief, you could almost ignore those variations. There's such a small part of the overall overall estate, and it, as long as the result that the court came out with is accurate based on when the partnership started, what's the complaint?
This is your statement, that, and in fact, you're very close to what you said in your answering brief. Judge Wong's varks really were not varks at all, but merely some unequal distribution of some assets, which brought the overall distribution closer to required 50-50 equalization for division of marital property, partnership property, with IRAs either favorable or not. In other words, forget calculating or forget understanding what she did. She wanted to do a 50-50, which you're assuming, we have no idea. And here's the division, and basically it's unreviewable.
No, what I'm saying
is, because we can't check her calculations, we don't know if she was doing 50-50, but here it is, and you say, you essentially acknowledge they weren't varks at all. She was just decided, I'm not gonna pay any attention to categories or anything else. I'm just splitting it, and I'm not even splitting all of it. I'm gonna just split some of it.
Yeah. No. What I think what I was trying to say there, maybe I wasn't as accurate as I could have been. What I was trying to say was, because I argue also that there were valid considerations for the varks, but what I was trying to say is. That, you know, even if you find that there were no valid considerations for the varks, and so the varks may have been quote unquote error, then take one step back and say, wait a minute, what's the overall result? Because we're talking about case law that applies to a statute, and the statute just says, be fair, family court, basically is what it says. And if so, if you step back and say, okay, the VARCs, maybe the VARCs weren't validly found, maybe. If not, step back and say, well, where's the error overall in this case? So is it really worth sending this case all the way back for another trial when the property after 20 years of relationship was split basically 50-50? Why step in and reverse what the family court did? That's what I was trying to say. I was trying to say that if you find error in the VARCs, you still don't need to reverse or even send it back to family court for any reason, because the overall picture is still 50-50. It's a perfectly valid, fair result based on the long relationship.
But that's your argument as to the valuation. We don't have her valuation, so we don't know how she would have valued these assets. And, you know, when, for example, with the property that turned out not to be part of the estate at the time of the divorce, we don't know how that factored into her calculations. How would someone go back and know how to even take that into account?
Okay, first of all, if you take a look at the chart that I did in the property division chart that I attached as Exhibit A to my brief,
and you listed that same property that she did. You didn't put a value, but you continue to list the East Kuahia property.
Yeah, but I gave it zero value because there's no. I believe you're going to find, and well, look, that issue has been remanded to the family court for decision. I think you will find, my belief is what the reason that's in there is not because it had any value, but because there was some dispute as to whether or not Mr. Gordon still may have had some interest in that. So the judge said, look, whatever interest you got is yours, but I'm not giving it anything. There's no evidence anywhere. The values that are on my chart are the values that the parties agreed to as of the date of marriage, date of divorce values, the DOSIPOT values.
All of the property needs to be readjusted according to the ICA opinion. Do you not agree with that?
Because no.
This is what it says. The conclusion says, we vacate in part the family court of the First Circuit's August 22nd, 2010 decree granting absolute divorce as it pertains to property division, including the award of the East Kuiaha Partners property to IRA.
Well, but I think that's what they meant. The only issue that the ICA mentioned, which they were concerned about in property division, was that property. So I think that's what they mean. What they mean is, okay, go back. Property division is the only issue that's being remanded, and only on this one particular point. What did you mean, Judge, when you did you give it value or not?
But that affects everything.
Well, but there's no evidence that she gave it any value whatsoever. If you look at my chart is based on the chart that even Mr. Gordon
submitted.
But
that's just what the Chief Justice just asked you. We don't know what kind of value or what was done. We're just guessing. We're
not
going to have the same family court just to remand it back down to.
No, I don't think that's true. The parties stipulated as to value on the date of trial. They stipulated, so all the property of the marriage, the values of the property were stipulated.
Value given to East Kuiaha?
No.
Actually, the defendants proposed, Mr. Gordon's proposed findings talked about East Kuiaha and did say that everything had been sold and that proceeds had been put into other things. It was not clear from his proposed findings as to whether or not any reinvestment was in the name of East Kuiaha.
Right.
And although he argues that Plaintiff's Exhibit 36 shows that East Kuiaha Partners had been dissolved, I didn't see any actual dissolution evidence.
That was the problem. And that's why in the decree, the judge, that's why it was drafted that way by the plaintiff's side, says, look, it's not really clear that you don't have any interest in it, but whatever you got, take it. It's yours. Forget, you know. But if you look at the stipulated values for the date of trial, there's no stipulated value for that property. And all she did was say, take whatever you got, we're not giving it any value. Then that's pretty clear, actually. But it's been remanded to clarify that one point, and when it gets remanded, that point will be clarified. And if the judge said, oh, yeah, I gave it $230,000 value, okay, well, then maybe there's some adjustment that needs to be made. But I think you're going to find that that's not what the judge
did. If we're going back to the stipulation, why wouldn't we also go back to the stipulation that there was a stipulation from both sides that IRA had $1.5 million in assets at date of marriage? Are we just going to look at part of these stipulations?
But just because Mrs. Gordon stipulated that he had this much on the date of marriage, that does not mean that she's conceding that those are Category 1 values. Okay, so he had $1.5 million on the date of marriage. That's great. And if that's Category 1, then he gets credit for it. As it turns out in this case, I mean, the parties didn't argue about valuations at certain dates. They stipulated. It does not mean she's conceding that there was no PEP, which goes back to 1993, and he had no values. Neither side really had any values. She did more than he did. But really, when you get right down to it, neither side really pinned down what values were for 1993. So if the marital partnership started in 1993, this is just a straight marriage with a bunch of assets on the date of trial or the dose of pot, and starting in 1993, and nobody's proved anything about Category 1. So it's 50-50, and which is exactly what the judge did. And based on the stipulated values that the parties agreed to on the date of trial.
But there's nothing in the findings to indicate that's what the judge actually was thinking. It certainly would be a lot easier for us if the court said that was its thought process.
Yes, sir. But that's true. And when I first looked at this case, I thought, whoa, this isn't exactly what I expect to see in a divorce case. As I say, if I drafted the findings and conclusions, I would have been a little clearer. But when I did the chart, then it was, at least in my chart, the first, as I mentioned in my brief, the first 27 values on my chart are the exact same numbers that were on their chart, exact same numbers. So, I don't think you have to look too far to figure out what the judge is doing. When the numbers come out almost 50-50 based on a marital partnership that started back in 1993, then I think you got a pretty good idea what the judge is.
Well, actually, but based on the findings, the earliest date that I can figure out for a finding of premarital economic partnership is January 12, 1995, where the judge says that the purchase of Molino Loop, these funds constitute a premarital capital contribution by plaintiff.
And well, the judge
later says that the court finds that the parties had a premarital economic partnership.
Right.
Relationship to Mona Loop's purchase.
That's true. It would have been nice if the judge pinned that down. But she does talk about, in leading up to that particular fine, you're right, she does say, okay, in 1995 they actually moved. But the judge does talk about Mrs. Gordon moving to out of Vegas, living with him in his place before they moved into her place, starting businesses in Vegas together, all kinds of stuff. They were her liquidating her 100,000 CD, helping him pay his taxes. He promised to pay money back, which he never did.
Well, if it's just a straight 50-50 division, why all the discussion by the court about the Varks and the financial misconduct and the
that's
like?
Why
is that there?
I think it overcomplicated the case. That's why I said, if you find that the Varks, what is this Vark thing in here? Then I still think you've got to stand back and say, wait a minute. If we agree that the family court had the discretion under the facts to find the premarital date was 1993, which means, and nobody proved any Category 1 in 1993, so we've just got a 20-year relationship with stipulated values on the date of trial, and it's split 50-50, there's nothing left to do. I mean, it's a fair division. Now, you could remand it to the judge and ask her to clarify, but it certainly doesn't need a new trial. And the result of this trial was a fair result. It was almost 20-year relationship, which was split 50-50.
What about alimony? So that's something that Mr. Esser is challenging, the award of alimony, suggesting it was based on inappropriate factors and didn't consider the proper factors.
Right, and he cites to the one, he says the one paragraph in the minute order which only sets forth these factors, and that's not sufficient. That's not true. If you look on the alimony issue in the findings of fact, there are almost 70 paragraphs in the findings of fact just for alimony. The judge first talks about Mr. Gordon's ability to pay, and then the judge talks about Mrs. Gordon's ability not to pay, which is exactly what you're supposed to do in awarding alimony. The first thing you're supposed to do is say, okay, the party who's asking for alimony, what's their need? The findings of fact are reversed. The first findings are about.
Does the court ever make a finding specifically as what her need was? I mean, there were income she had submitted. Something 8 months earlier, I think, that said she needed $1,300, and then all of a sudden we're looking at something different.
That it is true that when the judge said $3,000 for her, I didn't see anything in the record that specifically set that out, but the judge did state her position, though, that, you know, all she had, all she was living on was Social Security, which was being lean because of the tax problem which he created. That's all she had to live on. So that's in $3,000 a month. Again, the court's got pretty wide discretion on that. And $3,000 a month, that's not, you know, that's pretty real. I mean, try to live on $3,000 a month in Hawaii or even in Vegas or Texas where she went to live with her sister Nun. It's not a lot of money.
What about the issue of the substantial amounts of money that supposedly came in and out of her accounts during the time of the divorce? It's referred to in the application in the opening brief. There was an exhibit put into that effect. Very substantial amounts. I think it was $400,000, $300,000, something in the hundreds of thousands that she deposited and then withdrew from her own accounts. Is that a relevant factor? Is that something the trial court looked at or the family court looked at all? What, if any, significance do you place on that? Because it would seem to suggest she had other assets or other resources at her disposal.
Yeah. I don't remember either one of us actually significantly arguing that point.
Well, there was actually a post-decree. It's actually very strange. There was a post. Mr. Gordon's trial counsel initially refused to sign the proposed decree based on the motion for recon filed before the actual findings and decree,
right,
alleging the East Cuyaha issue and
right,
several other issues.
Right.
And then she wrote to the judge on August 20th and said, I'm being instructed to withdraw my proposed decree because I've uncovered additional perjury material fraud by Mrs. Gordon, and I'm going to be filing an amended motion for recon. And then she went ahead and signed the decree, approved it as to form.
When you say she, you mean?
Ms. Dong, the trial counsel. Mm. And Mr. Gordon actually approved the decree as to form and content, including that distribution of East Cuyaha.
Yeah.
And then she, after the findings, the decree, and the order denying the original motion for recon, there was a subsequent motion based on these funds, right?
Right.
What happened to that motion? It was unclear to me.
That's a good question, and that's not an issue on appeal, though, I don't think. So I remember there was an initial argument about the motion for reconsideration, but in my recollection, there's no issue on appeal either in the ICA or here about the post-trial claim of whatever. I don't remember arguing that issue or briefing it or seeing it from him.
So this issue, I think it was $380,000. It's a non-issue as far as you're concerned.
As far as I'm concerned, it's a non-issue. I don't remember hearing it, briefing.
So there was no separate order on that motion?
I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm trying to recollect, because the recon became not an issue on appeal, I'm not that up on it. As I remember, you know, they were raising, many of the issues that are raised on appeal were in the recon motion. So for those issues, you know, of course he preserves them anyway. But that particular issue, I don't remember anybody briefing that issue.
Now, what about the argument that improper factors were considered by the family court in essence punishing...
You mean for alimony?
Yeah, I'm sorry, for alimony.
Yeah.
That he was being punished for financial misdeeds, and that's not an appropriate consideration.
It's a nice argument, but it's not true, and that's why I refer you back to findings of fact 151 to 173, where the judge talks about Mrs. Gordon's inability to survive because all she's got is Social Security that's being leaned by the taxing authority, and findings of fact 105 to 150, almost, 46 paragraphs about Mr. Esser claims that, poor Mr. Gordon didn't have any money, but that's not what the court found. The court found he had Aloha homes, that it was if anybody, it's typical in a divorce, where as soon as there's a divorce, all of a sudden one party was making a lot of money, all of a sudden they're not making much money anymore, and they're just broke as heck. You know, this is so typical in a divorce case. The judge didn't buy that. She said, look, you got Aloha homes, you got Best Thai Massage, you got rent from the Iwahena warehouse, you can you're really good at 1031 exchanges. You can make a whole lot of money. Meanwhile, Mrs. Gordon has been working for 15 years, and all she's got is Social Security that's been lean because of your crazy tax avoidance issues. So it's not true. It's their argument that there were inappropriate issues. But if you look at all those findings of fact, almost 70 findings of fact just on the issue of alimony. So it's not just that one little paragraph in her minute order. It's all of those findings of fact that are summarized in that one little paragraph.
Well, could the court increase alimony in essence as compensation for or to somehow redress financial misdealings, or is that an impermissible factor?
No, and I mentioned in my brief, it does. There are cases that say that, you know, if a party has, this is one place where I think there seems to be a little bit of disagreement on the court about what do you do about matters that occurred during the marriage. Actually, we're not arguing. I'm more on Justice Pollack's side on that one. We're arguing that what happens during the the other issue is what's the date of separation. One thing I'm already on my time, but what's the date of separation? The date of separation was pretty clearly the time when he started living with his girlfriend. If you look at all the facts, it wasn't simply that he was having an affair with her. Mrs. Gordon testified that, yeah, I remember she was like dumb. He would show up from 2009 to 2010. The only time he'd show up was come in the morning for breakfast. He wouldn't live with her. He wasn't living with her at the house. Order her around, have a breakfast, and he'd take off. So it wasn't just that he was spending money on his girlfriend. He was living with his girlfriend from 2009 on. He wasn't living with Mrs. Gordon. Even though that one finding of facts is they were in a marriage together, living at the Malono Street. That's I think what that means
is. Isn't that
is,
your finding too? Didn't you propose it?
Yeah, but I think with that finding, I think you're taking that finding a little bit further than what it really means. I think all the court was trying to say was that they were married and the marital residence was Malono Street. But the actual testimony and what the judge relied on was poor Mrs. Gordon, and she testified too. She finally realized in 2010, after he shows up for breakfast, you know, for a year, and that's about all she ever sees of him, that she'd been abandoned, and that's when she filed for divorce. So that's the real date of separation.
I'm sorry, the real date was what?
The real date was sometime.
Or the step. Early. When was the substantial step taken?
When he started living with his girlfriend, which was in early to mid 2009. So it wasn't simply just spending money on her. He wasn't living with Mrs. And she testified to that in trial. And she, you know, I distinctly remember that. I was looking for the transcript site because I didn't see it in my brief. And for some reason, when I went on the website, we can see your cert petition, but I can't see the ICA case dropped off the website. So I can't get you the site. But she did testify, and I put that in my brief, that she would show up for breakfast, and then she finally realized after a year of this, in July of 2010, that she'd been abandoned for a year. And she, because I don't think she wanted to face that fact.
So a substantial step can be taken even if it's not communicated to the other party, in your view, as a matter of law?
Oh, definitely. I would say definitely. Yeah, I mean, because, you know, otherwise, then you're putting on the other party wanting to stay married, you know, really wanting, and then finally realizing, wait a minute, what am I, I'm such an idiot. The guy shows up for breakfast for a year, and I think I'm still married. Let's get this thing over with.
Can I just come back on the alimony? I'm sorry. Yeah. It's your position that the family court did not increase alimony because of the so-called financial misconduct, or that it was legitimate for it to do so?
What I was going to mention is, no, it is legitimate. One of the bases, and I cited in my brief, I'm sorry I can't find the page right now, but it's in my alimony discussion, that one of the issues on alimony is if the party who's being asked to pay alimony during the marriage has done things that really, really created a mess for the party who's asking for alimony during the marriage, that's one time when you can go digging into the past conduct. In other words, he puts her in such a bad position that, okay, he's got to make up for it. But that's the one place. I would tend to agree with Justice Pollack, then I'd be reluctant to dig in for property division purposes.
No, that's not my position. That's not what I even think the law is. The law doesn't look at the financial conduct. You're supposed to look at the financial condition. It's a different assessment. One is focusing on the conduct of the parties, which is not appropriate, but is much more appropriate. You're looking at present and future. So you're looking at the condition right then.
I agree.
Regardless of how they got there.
I agree. Yeah, I agree with that, but I think you can consider the way they got there was, there are specifically, and I have the cite in my brief, one of the things you can consider is how did, for alimony purposes, not for property division, is how did she get in such bad straits?
So if a person is negligent rather than intentional, the result should be different. In my view, it should be based upon the condition. Whether or not the guy was negligent or whether the guy was intentional, we want to make it fair by looking at the condition and not looking.
Yeah.
And this court seems to be focusing on the conduct rather than the condition.
You're right that it does kind of look like that, but if you look at the property, if you look at the findings of fact, 105 to 173, the court goes into great length on typical alimony analysis.
Based on the length of the marriage, the financial conduct of the parties as it affected the economic partnership of the parties both pre and post marriage. The court went all the way back to the very beginning looking at financial conduct to determine spousal support.
It's true she said that in that one paragraph, but if you read that together with findings of fact 105 to 173, you're going to see that she did a typical alimony analysis.
Anything further, Mr. King?
No, I have nothing.
Okay, very well. Mr. Esser.
First, I'm going to correct the record, Your Honor. I did not ask for a new trial, and I don't want to leave you without understanding. I asked for reconsideration. I would suggest this, though. If you look at the findings of fact, there's so many credibility findings that if that judge is no longer available, and I don't know her present status, but I don't think she's a plebeian anymore. If she still is and she's available, then it's fair to go back and have her reconsidered. Obviously, I'd like the court to take a different position on deviation and whether that's appropriate or not. But for purposes of sending it back, this is a findings failure. This isn't a trial failure. But
assuming that judge is available, you would say send it back to make the appropriate findings?
I don't want that, but that makes sense based on the challenges. There's another thing I want to correct in the record. And that is my reply brief. I respond to his answering brief by saying that the judge never mentioned my client's ability to pay. That's not entirely true. And it starts with, if you look at the paragraph, the famous paragraph I'm talking about, at one point in that paragraph, and this is in the ICA's opinion, after the judge basically uses that last finding of conclusion of law and the findings. This is conclusion of law 36 on the last page of this huge document where this basically tracks what's in that famous paragraph where she says, which you just quoted, Justice Pollack, both pre- and post-marriage financial conduct. That's pretty much the same finding that follows, by the way, all those findings of fact that supposedly address the issues. The point I want to make is this. That paragraph, this one doesn't contain any mention of ability to pay, but the paragraph in the minute order and the divorce decree does. It's at page 11 of the ICA opinion, and obviously it's also in the divorce decree and the minute order. And first she finds on the basis of these factors, on conclusion of law 36, that she's going to impose alimony. And then she says, I'm not going to award lump sum requested. Rather, given the reasons to order alimony and the ability of Ira to continue to generate income. Now, to me, that doesn't do enough, but it mentions ability to generate income. So I think it's misleading in my reply brief when I say nowhere does she ever mention ability. And I want to clarify that.
Thank you for that clarification. I guess I'd ask, would you respond to Mr. King's argument that there is a whole string of findings that are in essence addressing the kinds of factors that are typically taken into account in alimony, in determining alimony, his financial condition, her sort of lack of resources at the time. There's a quite a long string, at least that he claims really is addressing the factors that are typically considered in an alimony determination. What's your response to that?
Well, that's a little mushy. Not the question, but the argument. This is what I see. There's nothing in there about needs. As one of the justices pointed out, and I forgot who, I think it was Justice Pollack, there was no current financial statements. She didn't testify, and there's nothing in the findings on needs. Yes, there is some testimony about her potential future earnings, but there's nothing about needs. And there's no findings about needs. And it seems to me, how do you compute alimony? And all you have is the financial statement that goes back 8 months before, which says $1,300 a month. And that was including the $400 in Social Security. I wanted to point out.
In that regard, is there anything, your briefs do mention this $380,000 or so that was apparently going in and out of her account.
Yes. Both
the post-decree motion, was there ever a ruling on it?
Yes, it was signed by Judge Browning, and as he acknowledges in the answering brief, we have no idea if Judge Wong ever saw it. But yes, she just issued, Judge Browning signed a one-page order, and it was attached to the opening brief, I believe. You asked the question, or made some comment about...
No, that was the original motion for reconsideration.
Yes.
There was a post, a motion for motion after this.
That was a 60B.
Yes, the 60B. There was a subsequent motion based on this money going in and out of her account. What was the ruling on that?
That was in the recon, okay?
Okay.
And if you look at my footnote in the reply brief, 13 of the reply brief, bank records introduced at trial showed wife deposited and withdrew $380,000 from her bank account. All she did in that recon, Justice McKenna, is remind the court, hey, she had $380,000 there, so why do you keep talking about this? All she has is $411 a month from Social Security. What about the $380,000? You see where it says C Exhibit O and it cites the transcript? That was trial evidence. That was not a recon. That wasn't presented in recon or in the 60B. The 60B was filed because of lies.
Was there any testimony in the trial with respect to that $380,000?
Yeah, it's right there in the footnote. 625-12 transcript at 191 and Exhibit O.
I mean, was there any explanation?
Oh, no. I think it came in his testimony, and she had already testified. No, it wasn't responded to.
Wasn't there maybe $98,000 or something that was supposedly repayment from her sister or something?
Yeah, there were other issues, and right now I cannot recall. I just know that the $380,000 was in the opening brief, the reply brief, and it was just ignored. But and that's the response to Justice Rechtenwald's question, is that, and it has a huge impact. If she's claiming that she's only getting $400 a month of living in some, you know, bedroom in Waikiki, then what about the $380,000 that moved in and out of her account? That's what is certainly evidence that she had a lot more. I wanted to point out very quickly that counsel did not approve the form of the divorce decree. If you look at the exhibit, it says refused both by her client.
Oh, okay,
and her.
Thank you.
And I don't think that's any big deal anyway. I'm not saying that the fact you pointed out is not a big deal. But it seems to me generally, whether or not you approve of the form of a divorce decree or not is, doesn't have much impact.
Okay, that's a refused instead of a signature.
Yes.
Okay.
The way I can tell that, by the way, is that it's the same for both her and her client. So
okay.
Either forging his signature or hers.
In terms of the spousal support, since, and as I interpret it, I think they're going to have to look at the entire property division. There's a prior case, Garota versus Garota, where the court said...
My case.
Then didn't the court in that case say, because we're going to vacate the property division, and considering that the impact of the property division may have, we're going to ask the lower court to reevaluate the spousal support? Don't we have the same situation here?
I agree. Exactly. They're dependent, and they're especially dependent here when the same reason is given for both rulings. And look what she did with the taxes. She said, I'm not going to make him pay it. And of course, in my opinion, she shouldn't have no right to do that anyway because $116,000 was already due and owing. But assuming she had a right to order him to pay the whole $140,000, she is saying essentially, I'm going to give him, I'm going to give her a bunch of more alimony, $100,000 more instead. So for sure. But I would say this, look at the ICA's justification. They basically say that he was found not credible. And therefore, all his testimony about his earnings and the struggles with Aloha, which, by the way, are all reflected in the findings and are not contested in the findings, Yes, there's a lot of findings about his earnings. Look at them. It says that there's a downturn. It says that he has health problems. And none of those are contested. And the credibility findings do not mention the alimony issue. They don't mention. He is not found incredible when he talks about her. That's not true. One issue involving her, he is found not credible, and that is that she could get a job as a sales clerk. But in terms of her needs and his earnings and Aloha and the downturn, which, you know, can anybody here think anything else would happen during 2008, 2009 when a guy, his whole living is real estate? I mean, obviously he's going through a downturn.
But for an award of $3,000 a month, you know, we have a finding of fact that at the time of trial, wife had nowhere to live, no car, Social Security check of about $400 a month, $440 a month, being garnished and owed $140K in taxes. Then the next finding that at the time of separation, I realize there's an issue between separation and trial, husband was economically self-sufficient, had a profitable business, 3 retirement accounts, 2 cars, living with girlfriend and marital property. Given those respective state of affairs, can we say it's an abuse of discretion given the size or, pardon me, given the earning capacity of this defendant to suggest that a $3,000 a month award of alimony is an abuse of discretion?
Yeah, and the good question, but the problem I have with that is you're supposed to file a financial statement. You're supposed to say, here's the rent, here's the food, here's the medical. They're, just say, oh, she's only has Social Security and she's struggling. That does not support. The court isn't addressing needs. All the court is saying is that she only has $400 a month and she's living in a room somewhere. The way you support alimony is you file a statement, and the only statement in the record says she needs $1,300 a month. I mean, that's the problem. But I would say this, I don't care what is in the findings in terms of normal, predictable alimony rulings. Look at the last paragraph in the findings, and what it says is, because of 20 years of financial misconduct, I'm giving this lady alimony. That's what it says. The fact that she may have also taken some observations about how little money she had doesn't cut it. I don't want this court to just focus on the lack of evaluation and the lack of evaluation and categorization. I obviously think that's really important, Justice Pollack. But I want this court to go back with a finding on deviation. This court at some point should either reject or adopt Higashi, Chen. Chen's a 127 Hawaii opinion, just came out. And Alo and Kraytek and all these opinions. This court needs to say whether or not the Higashi rationale makes sense. And if it does, if that goes back, it's going to have a profound effect. I don't want this just to go back and have the judge go, oh, well, you want me to file the findings? All right, I will. She needs to be told, or whoever, that you got to file Higashi. And you can't award alimony and property division based on, my time's over, based on 20 years of misconduct, as eloquently said by Justice Pollack. Anything further?
Very well. If there's no further questions, thanks to both of our counsel for your arguments today. The court will take this matter under advisement.